Peter, you have the microphone.
All right. Good afternoon and welcome. We apologize for our technical difficulties at the start of today's session, but we are all set to go. Welcome to the February session of the ADA Audio Conference Series. The ADA Audio Conference Series is a project of the ADA National Network. The ADA National Network is funded by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Administration on Community Living, National Institute on Disability, Independent Living and Rehabilitation Research. The ADA National Network is comprised of 10 regional ADA centers. We are very pleased that you have joined us today for today's session. Today's speaker is someone who is quite familiar with the ADA National Network, as she had served for a time as the director of the Northeast ADA Center. So we are pleased to have with us today Suzanne Breyer. She is the director of the Program on Employment and Disability at Cornell University. Following Suzanne's presentation today, we will have an opportunity for participants to ask questions. For those of you participating on the telephone, we'll bring our Heather back to give you instructions. Those of you in the webinar room, as you heard from the instructions from Claudia, you can type your questions into the chat area during the session today. So without further ado, I would like to turn it over to Suzanne. Welcome, Suzanne.
Thank you, Peter. It's great to be here with folks that I know well from the past and also new folks out there. I'm delighted to see so much interest in this topic and really pleased to have an opportunity to share with you what we have been working on, and I hope it's relevant to our listeners today. I will also acknowledge that this material that we will be presenting today has been funded by the same funding organization that funds our ADA centers, and that is the Department of Health and Human Services, National Institute on Disability, Independent Living, and Rehabilitation Research. And we have had a grant for approximately 6 years, but many years, a good 25 years of research looking at employer practices and how that impacts the experience of inclusion, successful hiring, and inclusion of individuals with disabilities. And what we're going to share with you today is a big picture overview of the concerted effort we've made in the last set of years, last 5 to 6 years, to look across many different sources of information to better understand where people with disabilities are working, and where hiring and integration of people with disabilities is working, and how employers are doing in that, and share with you the sources of information and what we found from them, both to provide an overview of where information can be found, but also the specifics of what we've learned is effective good practice and what can better facilitate for both employers and for people who are providing consultation services, like many of you out there, to employers, a way forward for us all to do a better job in that process. The title that we have today is Employer Practices to Improve Employment Outcomes, Considerations Across the Employment Process, and we call at that because it's not just getting people in the front door. What we're finding is it's very important to help think through and educate employers about recruitment hiring, but also retention, advancement, and a experience of inclusion for people with disabilities. So, first thing I'm going to talk about is why we believe and focus on employer practices across the employment process is important, and give you some examples of why, documentation of why we believe so. And then we're going to talk about the data sources where we been able to gather some information from, and how that's been a very interdisciplinary effort. And what I mean by that is we've had a fantastic team of people from a lot of different types of professional and academic scholarly expertise contribute to our work using different data sources and many different types of techniques, and I'll talk a little bit about that. I think what's going to be probably of most interest to those of you who have joined us today is understanding what we've learned from this inquiry across so many different people and sources of information, and specifically what the implications are for employers who are trying to do a better job in disability workplace inclusion, but also for those of us who are providing training and technical assistance services to businesses to help them in doing so. And we're going to leave you with online resources for future reference, both sources of information that give in-depth scholarly summaries of what we're doing, but also some online tools we've created to make it easier for people to access this information when they need it. So why focus on employer practices? I think I probably don't have to do a hard sell to all of you out there, or you wouldn't have joined us today, but indeed it is very timely to be focused on these issues for a whole host of reasons. Always, I think it's always true that listening to the voice of employers and finding out from them what's working and not working and what inspires and makes it possible for them to proactively work on employment of people with disabilities as well as advancement and retention is important. But we also know that contextually we are, it's a good time to be doing so because there are federal regulations that support those of us who have an interest, both employers and disability advocates, trainers, in doing so right now. And that's both in the private and in the federal sector. In the federal sector, there's an initiative to do concerted hiring, which has been in place for quite a while now, presidential order. And a bar for federal agencies to approximate with affirmative action requirements. But the same is also true for federal subcontractors in the private sector, an initiative which has been there, but in the last 2 years has much more precision to it with a 7% aspirational goal across the all job categories for federal subcontractors of $10,000 or more. So selected organizations, both in the federal and in the private sector, have targeted hiring initiatives. But in addition, more broadly than that, and that is 2.3 million, I believe, in the federal sector, employees and about a quarter of the American workforce fall under federal subcontractors. So what we're talking about is a sizable part of the American workforce. It's not an insignificant part of our labor workforce to be paying attention to. But over and above that, as many of us know, that there are many changes in the workplace and the workforce, which makes it important for us to be looking at what's happening and what impact that has on employer practices. And some of the things to be thinking about, of course, is contingent workforces, more subcontracting and outsourcing of jobs, which we should be aware of and how it will impact people with disabilities, but also the changing nature of a very technology-intensive workplace now. And so being able to afford people the skills that they need to be able to be marketable in that environment is important for those of us who are preparing people with disabilities for the workforce. As I mentioned, attention needs to be across the employment process because it can be at any point from getting a job to losing a job at the end of that process that disability discrimination can occur or accommodation may be needed, and it's important to help equip employers, supervisors, hiring managers with the skills and awareness they need to be able to get out in front of that and do a good job, a responsible job of responding when people articulate their needs. And we believe to be effective in identifying what's effective practices that we need to be drawing from many sources, which you'll hear more about today. So first of all, a bit about our data sources and the interdisciplinary nature of the way we have gathered data over this several-year time period. As I mentioned, we've used a wide array of data sources, such as large data set analysis. We worked with census data and administrative data. We conducted surveys both with employers and with people with disabilities. We've conducted interviews within organizations of HR managers, supervisors, people with disabilities, and coworkers, and conducted focus groups with those types of populations. In the same settings, some in different settings, different types of organizations, working both in the federal and the private sector. We also have had an opportunity to do deep dives, case studies into organizations, which means we've employed several of those other tools, surveys, interviews, and focus groups, and gathering more data in particular companies or federal agencies. And we've also at different times looked at archival data within those organizations and drawn from other sources as well. It's been transdisciplinary in that we've worked across disciplines, trying to pull in each of these inquiries, pull from the best of the knowledge from different types of disciplinary areas like rehabilitation psychology, rehab counseling, industrial organizational psychology, special education, economics, statistics, math. We have had an environmental design and analysis, a colleague work with us, as well as social work, law, and others. So we've been able to get a wide variety of perspectives and understandings of both literature and methodology in this. And critical to it has been that employers themselves have been our partners throughout this process in the design of the research, in the shaping of the research questions, as well as data gathering process and analyzing, looking at the outcomes and helping us to make sense, to have a valid interpretation of what we were seeing. All a very important part, we believe, of the validity of the findings. I believe I talked a little bit about this, a variety of data sources. I didn't give you specifics about it, but the first bullet here says national survey data, and indeed we drew from a wide variety of data sets, I believe 9 total, that predominantly from the American Community Survey and the current population survey. But in this process, we've created, and I'll talk a bit about that, was one of our resulting online tools, is a database that talks about what are the data sets that has employment data and disability data, as well as compensation data that can inform our understanding of how people with disabilities are faring. We drew from administrative data, and an example of that is the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission data, and I'll talk a bit more about that in just a moment. And as I mentioned, we've done a set of surveys and in-depth case studies. And we also surveyed people with disabilities, family members, and service providers to make sure that we balanced perspectives across the respective inquiries using some similar items and some separate items. And I will, in each of these cases, share examples of how we've used those kinds of sources to find out more about what employers are doing and the status of people with disabilities, and some specific findings. I want to first mention a separate but related resource, because this is where we now archive some of these new data information, and that is that Cornell University has a website that we think is very useful for snapshot information about the status of people with disabilities across a wide variety of topics, but we specifically focus most on employment, and it's at www.disabilitystatistics.org. On that website, if you have interest in your own state data, you will find a disability status report. We've just finished our 2017 effort, which uses 2015 data, and we have a U.S. report that summarizes data across all states, as well as individual state status reports. For all the states plus District of Columbia and Puerto Rico. So those of you who are trying to make the case about the importance of these issues will be able to get information that is pretty readily available, downloadable by year. We encourage people to look at the most recent year, but you certainly can go back a number of years because we've been doing this for quite a while now. And get information on your state or the national level to talk about the status of people with disabilities on employment, on education, on household income and poverty. And here's some examples of those data using and how you can articulate the case for the need for attention. Here's an example of using employment rate, and this employment rate is just on working age people, as the government usually defines it, and that's 21 to 64. And this figure here shows that people with disabilities who are noted in red, approximately 35% of people with disabilities are employed compared to their non-disabled peers who are employed at a rate of better than 78%, which is a gap of 43%. So this data, taken from the American Community Survey and National Bureau of Labor Statistics effort, Census Bureau data, is helps us to understand concretely the importance of focusing on employment issues for people with disabilities, because compared to their non-disabled peers, they are obviously significantly under-employed and unemployed. So it's really important to pay attention to these issues. Another compelling, I think, statistic that comes out of these efforts is what results when you have these kinds of disparities in employment, where the status of people with disabilities is concerned. It translates into a higher level of poverty rate for people with disabilities and a significantly lower median annual household income. So in this example here, you see again in red and blue, the red line in this figure shows that people with households with people with disabilities has an annual household income of $41,600 compared to people without disabilities. And again, this is 2015 data, which we've just calculated, compared to $65,900 for people without disabilities. So that's a gap of over $24,000 a year. So indeed, having employment disparities significantly contributes to lower available resources within a household. It's a very important issue for us to be paying attention to. So these are examples, both the status reports more broadly and these couple of snapshot figures, of the value of working with national survey data that gathers information on the economic situation for people with disabilities and compares that to the non-disabled peers. It gives us very concrete information at a state down to a local level of how people with disabilities are faring compared to others to help us make informed decisions about where to put energy in trying to make a difference in this area. We also can learn a lot from administrative data sets, which is data gathered by particular organizations, either federal agencies, state agencies, or it can be other organizations, not-for-profits as well. In our case, an example of a data set that we have found useful is the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission's employment discrimination charge data. And we have focused there because, as many of you know, being people who provide information on the ADA, this is the enforcement organization, enforcement federal agency for Title I, or the employment provisions of the Americans with Disabilities Act. So it provides useful information for us to look at where people are perceiving discrimination and coming forward and filing a charge. And in order for us to be able to do this, we as individuals have to have an Interagency Personnel Act agreement, an IPA, with the federal government, which gives us permission to use the data in a two-year period, and then we need to reapply. So the data is very carefully guarded. You have to make the case for what you would use it for and get permission to use it. And we have access to charges across all statutes, not just employment, but also aging, gender, race, ethnicity, so that we can make comparisons with other kinds of discriminatory actions and how people are perceiving that. From 1993, which is the first year we have a full year of data from the Title I of the ADA through 2014, and we will get additional data as time goes along, but it takes a year or two for the data to be made available to us. In this data, we can look at trends in charges, so what happens over time. That's the benefit of having it across multiple years. Are people perceiving different kinds of issues over time, or are different types of people with different types of disabilities, is their perception and their willingness to file changing over time? And what are the particular issues and bases for those discrimination charges? And we can also make comparisons to other forms of discrimination because we have it across different types of laws. So here are some examples of what we see. Not surprisingly, because it's once someone is in the workplace, they are more likely to be able to understand whether or not they're receiving differential treatment in a workplace, is that almost 3 out of 5, 58.2% of the discrimination charges that are being filed under the ADA, and this is from 2005, this is just a 10-year snapshot, to 2014, are being filed under the issue of discharge, followed by at 31% reasonable accommodation, 1 in 5 or 20% terms and conditions, 15.4% harassment, about 10% disciplinary areas, and less than 10% hiring at 6.2, and then other at 6.7. So. And I would say discharge is more often the highest across all of the other types of discrimination as well. But it's important for us to realize that it's not just getting in the front door, but it's also staying and not being differentially discharged from your job. That's really important to people with disabilities. Another thing we can take a look at with this data is what the most common bases are or types of disabilities. And this figure shows us, and again, this is over a 10-year period, 2005 to 2014, that about 10% or 16 if you go across the top two, have to do with orthopedic impairment, not surprising, since many times this comes along with the aging process if it's something we experience earlier. And more than 10% if we combine depression at 6, other anxiety disorder at 4.4 is in the mental health area. And then less, but still significant, is diabetes, cardiovascular, and cancer, which is less than 5, between 3 and 4.5%, but cumulatively about 10%. And sometimes these kinds of issues are higher preponderance as we age. So this is where employers need to be thinking about their aging workforces and getting out in front, knowing how to effectively accommodate people with these types of disabilities. And that's the approach we usually take when we talk to employers, is to say, here are some things, here are some areas, types of disabilities where people are perceiving that there's a problem in the way we're responding to them or approaching the accommodation process. And so understanding how your jobs may impact these disabilities and knowing how to effectively accommodate is a really positive, proactive way of approaching and getting out in front of potential issues. Another value of this data for us, as I mentioned to you, is looking at changes that occur over time. And here is one example of that. And this is 5 years' worth of data from 2005 to 2010. We were looking before and after the advent of the Americans with Disabilities Act Amendments Act. And what we do see is indeed there has been a change over that five-year period. And in this case, we were looking at, because we thought it was very interesting, we were focused on non-obvious disabilities to see if people were feeling more confident in filing after the Amendments Act. And indeed, whether that was the cause or not, we don't know. But we do see a gradual increase over that five-year period non-obvious disabilities, many of which, most of which, three out of five here, of which, am I right, three out of five, four out of five, which are mental health-related disabilities. The highest being depression, next cancer, third in prevalence, anxiety disorder, bipolar, manic depression, and PTSD. So four out of five non-obvious disabilities all are showing an increase of willingness of people to come forward and to file a complaint. So again, this significantly relates, as we mentioned, as we started out this afternoon, to those companies and agencies that have targets for people with disabilities and are increasing their efforts to have people report that they have a disability so they can count them in those numbers to make their quotas. If people have non-obvious disabilities, they may come forward and in that process may experience discrimination. So this would tell us that we need to think about how we are encouraging people to come forward and whether or not we have an appropriate protocol in place where they feel safe to do so and whether we are responding appropriate to that to them when they do disclose and request accommodations. So I'm going to pause for a second and see, are there any near-term questions that we need to respond to, Peter, or should we go on?
I am checking to see if we have any in the webinar room. Remember, you can submit questions in the chat area as we go along, and if you don't have questions now, we can certainly revisit them at the end. So why don't you go ahead and continue at this point, Suzanne?
I will, Peter. Thanks for checking for us. So I am going to now pick up. We talked about where we have been informing our insights about employer practices and what's going on from both national survey data and administrative data. And now I'd like to talk more about what we've learned from surveys, in-depth dives and case studies, interviews, focus groups. And as I will mention again, we've done this across the employment process, but I think it's well worthwhile talking about the specific sort of categories that we'd begun to look at as we did this process. Recruitment and hiring, of course, accessibility and accommodation, retention and career advancement, compensation and benefits, diversity and inclusion, and we also have learned a lot more, and we'll talk a bit about the important role that the manager plays in disability inclusion, and also what are some metrics and analytics that we can begin to encourage employers to consider gathering so that they have an understanding of how they're doing in this process. So I want to first mention another source of important source and a wonderful partner that we've had over the years. This is I'm going to give you the results of one survey, but this is the third or fourth we've done over the past 20 years with the Society for Human Resource Management. If you aren't aware of them, they are a wonderful representative of HR professionals' interests and helping to keep the this disciplinary area, this profession informed about all kinds of issues around the workplace. It's a very large organization. At the time we worked with them, there was approximately 250,000 members. There's now closer to 300,000. And they're a great source of information because they have representatives from across all kinds of industries and organizational sizes. And as we drew our sample to get a litmus of what the perspectives of this membership organization's representatives thought about these issues, we stratified the sample so that we would get a good representation across industries and organizational sizes. And we did both an online survey, but also called people who had not responded to the online survey to get as big a sample as we could of respondents. We asked them questions about recruitment and hiring, accessibility and accommodation, retention and advancement, barriers, metrics, and training. And I will just skip across some examples of what we found in each of those things in the interest of time, but just to show you the kind of information we could get. We did this data collection 5 years ago, actually. It's taken us several years to analyze all the data in a host of different ways since that time. And we got a 23% response rate. We had a total pool of respondents of close to 700, 662. And here's what we found. This first slide on this data, I'm going to share with you what the perceptions were of these respondents, this 662 individuals, to what they told us were the barriers to employment or advancement from their perspective as HR representatives for their respective companies for people with disabilities. And interestingly, the top three in numbers have to do with our preparation or the preparation of individuals with disabilities for the workforce. And, you know, I think any of us who work in that area would say, indeed, we could certainly do a better job of getting people the skills and experience they need. So it's lack of qualified applicants. 2 out of 5 told us was their biggest barrier to hiring people or advancing people with disabilities, followed by 35% lack of related experience in the person, and 30% lack of requisite skills and training. So I think that tells us that we need both better public policy to infuse resources into areas of preparation for people with disabilities. It gets them tooled up for the contemporary workforce. But I think also, and in further inquiry, we understood that we don't know how much of this is perception as well. Part of it is adequate preparation, and part of it is the eye of the beholder of our hiring managers and supervisors. So we know that there's a perception there that people are not prepared, which we also need to work on. Approximately 1 out of 4 saw supervisor knowledge of accommodation as a barrier to employment or advancement. So that tells us that we need to do some education of supervisors around these issues, where they can get the resources and information they need when a request comes to them from someone whom they're supervising about an accommodation. 1 out of 5 said the cost of accommodation, but interestingly, that's getting lower now. About 1 out of 6 said attitudes and stereotypes within the workforce. And so, again, this is an educational outreach issue that we could be working on and employers themselves are working on. Far fewer, 13%, said productivity and performance concerns around people with disabilities, and less than 10% that it was their concern about the additional cost of supervision or cost of training or even the attendance of people with disabilities. So that tells us something about where we need to educate people in workforces and provide supports and information when needed, which we thought was helpful. So I have mentioned that we gathered information on recruitment, hiring, retention, advancement, accessibility. And one of the things, so what you're going to see here, what I'm going to share with you, is how our HR professionals in this SHRM survey responded about what they're doing. And then we also want to talk about, is what they're doing going to make a difference? Is it, what is significant about learning about this? So here's what we found out. Where recruitment and hiring is concerned, we came up with a list of what we know to be good practices from the literature and from prior studies that have been done, put those in a checklist, and then asked our respondents, were they doing them and to what degree, and what was helpful. And what we found is that 3 out of 5 indeed were putting people with disabilities in their diversity and inclusive and inclusion plans. Over half had relationships with community organizations where they would try to proactively do recruitment of people with disabilities. 45% were doing active recruitment, what they self-identified as active recruitment. A little more than a third said they had strong senior management commitment. A little more than a quarter said they used tax incentives for hiring people with disabilities. 1 in 4 said that they had explicit goals for people with disabilities. Less than 1 in 5, 19%, said that they had internships that were targeting people with disabilities within their organization for work experience. Less than that, 17%, said that they included persons with disabilities and target goals in the management performance criteria of their managers. So that's what these companies' representatives told us that they were doing. And what we found out, we then also asked them, had they hired in the last year? And if they've been hiring, did they hire a person with a disability? And what we found is these practices, being able to do these practices, seemed to contribute positively to hiring people with disabilities. And certain practices seemed to have a higher probability that that would occur. For example, internships was the most powerful predictor of whether or not a company would have hired a person with a disability in the past year. If a company had been doing that, it was 6 times more likely they would have hired if they had internships. 5 times more likely if they had strong senior management commitment. 4 times more likely they would have hired if they had explicit goals for targeted hiring for people with disabilities. 3 times more likely to have hired a person with a disability if they were actively recruiting or had people with disabilities in their diversity and inclusion plans or had relationships with community organizations. So this is very persuasive to take this information to companies when they say, what can I do to increase the likelihood that we're going to be effectively able to attach people with disabilities to our workforce in the coming year, we can give them a list of what we know now heightens the likelihood of that occurring, which is persuasive, and we can provide consultation on. So we find this very useful information for employer consultation.
Suzanne, can I ask you to just please mention the slide numbers?
Yes, I can certainly do that. I am now on slide 28, and my apologies for not catching that earlier. I know some of you are tracking me by having downloaded the slide. So I am now on, that was slide 28 where I cited this information. Slide 29, I'm going to talk about what we found out. Again, same survey, same group of informants, HR professionals, around accessibility and accommodation. And here again, we had a list of good practices and we asked them what they were doing. We found out 3 out of 4 of them, not surprisingly, does have a designated office or person to address accommodation questions within their organization. A little less, but still 71%, allows an employee to exceed maximum duration of medical leave as an accommodation. About 2/3 has an established grievance procedure to address reasonable accommodation issues. Little more than 2 out of 5 have a written, formal, documented decision-making process for handling accommodations on a case-by-case basis. 39%, so again, about 2 out of 5, provides advanced notice to job applicants that reasonable accommodations are provided during the job application process. And about the same amount evaluates pre-employment occupational screenings to ensure that they are unbiased. A little more than 1/4 regularly reviews the accessibility of online application systems to people with visual, hearing, finger dexterity, or cognitive impairments. And about 1 in 5 has a centralized accommodation fund. So as you can see, you know, a wide variation in terms of the proportion of companies that can self-report doing any of these good practices, and yet we know the more they are doing them, the higher the likelihood that effective accommodation will occur. And we asked these folks to also rate in their mind what were the most effective of these policies. And they told us, interestingly, because only less than 1 in 5 had them, that they felt that having a centralized accommodation fund was the most effective thing one could do. Having a designated office or person to address accommodation questions, also very effective, and many of them did have them, 3 out of 4 have them, and also a formal process for provision of accommodations, and yet you know, not all of them have them, although more than half did. So when working with employers, and if they ask what can we do to more effectively accommodate, here's some things we feel quite confident you could take to employers to tell them to focus on these areas, and it probably will help their accommodation process. I'm going to move on now and make sure we get these things covered. Again, still from our survey with HR professionals, we asked them about retention and advancement policies and practices that would help to, in their view, help with retention and advancement of people with disabilities. And again, we had a predetermined set of what were good policies from prior research and from the literature, and we found out that 3 out of 4 have a return to work or disability management program for employees who are ill or injured somehow impacted by a health-related or a disability-related issue, not necessarily covered by the ADA, but they do have this return to work program. A little more than half has workplace flex policies and practices that mean that a person can have flex time or part-time work arrangements or work from home. 2 out of 5 invite employees to confidentially disclose whether they have a disability. I now think that probably there are certainly more because of the new provisions that have occurred in the last 5 years, but certainly at this time, only 2 out of 5 were doing that. Less than 1 out of 5 has a structuring mentoring program to support employees with disabilities or offers special career planning or development tools for employees with disabilities. Only 13% had a disability-focused employee network or affinity group or resource group, or had explicit organizational goals related to retention or advancement for people with disabilities. And less than 10% included progress toward retention or advancement goals for employees with disabilities in the performance expectations of their managers. And again, we asked about their perceptions of how effective these were. And even though, as you just heard, many of these were at the lower end, a lot of companies weren't doing them, we also had the HR professionals telling us that these were important and indeed, when done, were very effective. And interestingly, although not many are doing it, having a disability-focused employee network can be very, very helpful for retention and advancement. Having a return to work program or disability management program, not surprisingly, 3 out of 4 have them. Flexible work arrangements for all employees and mentoring programs to support employees with disabilities, although not many of our company's respondents had that as well. So again, good practices we can talk about with employers if they're losing employees with disabilities from their workforce who they've already had in there. Here are some things to help them think about how to be able to keep them more effectively. Now, I mentioned another thing that we are concerned about and interested in is helping companies to figure out how to assess their progress. So we did ask them about what they're currently measuring, and we found out that not very many are currently tracking disability-related metrics. Less than 1/3 keep data on accommodations of any kind. Less than 30% keep information on the number of applicants hired. Less than that, 23% on the number of job applicants with disabilities that they have. Less than 1 in 5 keep any statistics where disability is concerned on employee retention and advancement or on grievances from employees with disabilities. And less yet, 14% and 11% data kept on compensation equity or turnover rates of employees with disabilities. And yet these help organizations, all of these, understand are they getting people in the front door in equitable proportion to what they want to hire? Are they making it through the interview processes and into the workforce? And once there, are they being equitably treated where compensation advancement is concerned? So really important to keep metrics and important to get companies thinking about what metrics they could keep and how they can build that into their already existing mechanisms, because many of them are keeping data on other types of protected populations. So it's getting them to do that also for people with disabilities. So the next information I want to share with you is what we learned when we did deeper dives into individual companies. We just talked about an across-company survey that we did with HR professionals, but now we want to talk about data that we gathered from different companies, getting input from specific representatives across a number of companies and then deep dives into companies. And we work specifically with 7 working groups of employer representatives from HR, diversity and inclusion, EEO, and others. And in that, we identified key issues, promising policies and practices, and needed future training and tools. And some of this preceded the survey I just described and helped to inform the design of that survey and the categories that we selected to ask in that survey group with SHRM. So some of them preceded and some of them were follow-up to help us understand what we learned and what needed next steps were for information. Some of the things we found gathering data from these employers more directly, something that was very surprising to us because we've always focused a lot on HR professionals and the role they play in minimizing disability workplace discrimination and maximizing inclusion, was employees with disabilities are at least 60% more likely to disclose their disability to their supervisor than to HR. And that dramatically flagged to us the importance of getting to supervisors and helping them be more adequately prepared to deal with these inquiries when they come. And some of the things that, you know, that we found in these slides to follow, I will give you more specific information, but I think just generally it's important to know that managers are key to the quality of workplace experiences of all of us, but particularly of people with disabilities. Their perceptions of the organizational motivation for disability inclusion also is really important. It's far better if the manager perceives that disability inclusion and attention to accommodation is not just being done for regulatory compliance purposes, but because it's really in the interests of the company, in the mission, in the fabric of the strategy of the company to be truly inclusive of all people, but including people with disabilities. And that perception of the manager impacts the disability climate. It makes a difference in terms of the experience of the person with a disability. And we know that disability disclosure will therefore more often occur with manager and coworker rather than HR, and then the education and training around disability disclosure is really important with this manager if you're going to foster a truly inclusive workplace culture where people feel comfortable disclosing. We found, however, sadly, that over 70% of the managers that we surveyed were unaware of whether in their company some of the practices were in place that we just talked about. We asked them across that some similar lists, and the list is below there of 10 items, what they knew about from their company. And their awareness was lowest for those disability practices in red, and I'll read what those are. Targeted recruiting of people with disabilities, they were not aware. A higher proportion of them were not aware of whether or not those companies had them, whether they had a centralized source of funding for accommodations, and yet knowing that would mean that the manager would know that they have a place to go to get their accommodations if they had someone inquiring. They were least likely to know about whether or not there was a formal written documented decision-making process for accommodation on a case-by-case basis, so it's not likely that they would encourage people to access it or use it, apply it themselves in the interaction with the individual with a disability. Less likely to know about regular review of the accessibility of their organization's job application systems. Since I think this one's more understandable and that they don't design those often, but it means that they may be oblivious to the fact that they're not getting candidates with disabilities because those company websites are inaccessible. So it is important that the company attend to that and let people know that they're doing their best to try to get people in the front door. And they also were less likely to know whether there was hiring training occurring to maximize utility of the hiring process in terms of disability inclusion. They were not aware if that was occurring. So they probably had not themselves personally experienced it. So lots of need for education. Many companies may have these resources, policies, and practices, but certainly managers are not aware of them in more cases than not. The range of lack of awareness was from 40 to 70% across all the organizations that we did these case study surveys with. we also know not only knowing about the practices, but the perception of their efficacy is really important. The managers, how they perceive the efficacy of the disability practices was positively associated with the employees' perceptions of the organization's commitment to disability-related goals. So it's not only important that the organization conveys to these supervisors that they have the resources, but that there's a sense of belief in how effective they are, that gets conveyed to the manager, and that impacts, permeates the experience of the individual and their sense of whether or not these effective practices are really making a difference in the organization. We also know that employees are less likely to report experiencing bias or discrimination based on their disability when their managers, if the managers they work for are aware of their organization's disabilities, policies, and practices and believe they are effective. So this relates back to the other data source I told you about workplace discrimination charges being filed. You can do a lot to mitigate that as a problem for organizations if you really are not only creating the policies and practices, but sending the message that it's a strategic imperative to use them. It's a part of the diversity and inclusion imperative of the company, and that you're behind them and will help to make them effective. That really makes a difference in the workplace culture. We know that experiences for people with disabilities are much better in units that do some of the things we were just talking about. Individuals with disabilities who work in inclusive climates report significantly greater success at having their accommodation requests granted, greater coworker support of their accommodations, better experiences of procedural and interactional justice during accommodations, lower levels of disability harassment and discrimination, and higher organizational commitment and satisfaction. And this results in lower turnover rates. So everybody benefits when you really try to put an inclusive work disability inclusive workplace in place. We also know, as I mentioned, that experiences at the individual level for employees with disabilities are also better when they have good relationships, not surprisingly, with their managers. When individuals experience themselves as being a part of the in-group for their managers rather than discriminated against, they report having a higher fit between their skills and the demands of the job, so there's more attention being paid to get them in the right job, match that up with their skills. They feel a higher sense of empowerment. They report fairer treatment during the accommodation process. They also report a higher organizational commitment, satisfaction, and willingness to engage in what we call citizenship behaviors, or really going above and beyond the requirements of the job to contribute to the organization. And then again, that means lower turnover rates for their employees with disabilities. I also want to mention that although in these surveys, these were organizational surveys where we got this data from people with disabilities, we also made a concerted effort to go out and just recruit from a much broader public of people with disabilities about perceptions on select things, a deeper dive yet here. And we did that by working in collaboration with the American Association of People with Disabilities and SAMHSA, government organization focused on mental health and substance abuse, because we wanted to get the perspectives of people with disabilities and a number of things, but disability disclosures where I'm going to focus on here. We did an online survey, and we recruited people by using social media and newsletter announcements of these in other related disability organizations. And here's what we found. We asked people what would make a difference. And again, we were doing a drill down on workplace climate for disability inclusion. What would make a difference making you feel comfortable in disclosing your disability, since there are now employers who have a vested interest in helping individuals, employees, applicants do so. And we found out that more than two-thirds said if they needed an accommodation, and this was about 600 people who we had as respondents of people with disabilities, better than two-thirds said that if they needed an accommodation, they would come forward. About 3 out of 5, a little better than that, said if they had a supportive supervisor relationship. A little more than half said if they saw a disability-friendly workplace, knew of active disability recruiting by their organization, knowing of other successes when somebody came forward and disclosed within their organization. About half said that. A little less than half said disability. They saw a disability in their diversity statement. And 2 out of 5 said they would come forward if they had a belief that there would be new opportunities for them in their workplace if they chose to disclose. We also asked them, since these are things that would facilitate disclosure, were there things in their work environment that would impede that? And what we found, indeed, there was. 3 out of 4 said they wouldn't come forward because they had a fear of a risk of being fired or not hired. 2/3 said that they were concerned that the employer might focus on the disability, or they had a risk of losing their health care, a fear of limited opportunities. About 3 out of 5 said they were concerned that the supervisor may not be supportive. A little more than half said they were concerned about a risk of being treated or viewed differently by the people around them if they disclosed. About 2 out of 5, 44%, said they wouldn't come forward because they didn't believe it had any impact on their job ability advancement if they disclosed. And a little more than 1/4 said a desire for privacy. So that was, interestingly, the least important reason for people not to disclose within that category. And so with that, I want to move, and then we'll make some time for questions again with help from our moderator, summarizing across all these different data sources and different data gathering methodologies that I just mentioned and different informants, what I believe are things to keep in view as you move forward, either as an employer, if you're an employer representative on this event today, or if you're providing consultation services to employers. First of all, it is really important to have top leadership commitment. If nothing else, it's really important that the message gets sent from the top that people with disabilities are a clear priority and that they're wanted in the organization and that there will be an affirmative effort to do so, and minimizing barriers is an imperative, whether it be access to a website that's accessible, or it's informing your hiring managers, that needs to be evident in the organization. And it's important, although the message needs to come from the top, that middle management is also mobilized in that effort, and that people with disabilities are in those positions, in leadership and in middle management positions, so that they can reinforce that by their not only their voice, but by their modeling, role modeling, and behavior. Next, it's really important to assign responsibility. Somebody needs to be in charge of this initiative, this strategy, and it's across the board in terms of many of the policies and practices we talked about. It needs to be in charge of attracting, and once in the workforce, of engaging and advancing people with disabilities. Someone needs to have their eye on the ball, even though that's a dispersed responsibility across often supervisors and middle managers. It's important that someone's paying attention to the metrics and analytics being kept and how the organization is doing. Next, 3rd, it's important to find a partner, someone to help you get the qualified candidates in the pipeline in your applicant pool. And that can be a state vocational rehabilitation agency or some other not-for-profit local area community service provider, or it might be a profit provider as well, but someone who is a conduit for you as a business organization in getting the candidates that you need. Other good practices, establishing, as we mentioned, employee resource groups or business groups. This is a way to identify leaders with and without disabilities who have an interest in disability area, and then it's an opportunity to create partnerships across units, within units, and across other interests. So it might be an employee resource group on disability, but that could be aligned with the diversity group as well, or it might be the technology group. There's a whole host of ways of infusing disability into other special resource groups when you have that energy coalesced. And they can also help with targeted initiatives like conducting accessibility audits or get involved in recruiting, and all of that can be very helpful of moving this agenda along a wide variety of tasks or activities. Making managers accountable, I think we talked about it. It's important that disability goals, that diversity goals with a disability focus are embedded in the performance plans for managers and supervisors. And finally, it's important to measure for understanding and results. You know, what do people understand about disability in your climate surveys? That's one place to embed it, but also getting input through your employee resource groups, another litmus. I think specifically, two more items. I'm forgetting how many I had here. Make it safe to self-identify. We talked quite a bit about what are the practices that impede or facilitate. Most employees with disabilities are actually not, it may not be obvious, are unidentified or become disabled post-hire, so it won't be necessarily at the front end that you would have asked them that question. So it's important to make disclosure safe and provide reasons for people to disclose, like offering flexible work options or access to accommodations if they do. And important to raise understanding and skill levels of everyone in the workforce about disability inclusion. So it's important to train everyone in the workforce on etiquette and understanding. It's a way of helping to reduce fear of interacting with people with disabilities and better ensuring that managers understand their roles and accountabilities. So in summary, if you are providing consultation to business or you're a business yourself, be knowledgeable about the regulations that are influencing employer interest in disability hiring. We talked about a couple. Many of our colleagues who are on this call today, on this webinar today, are knowledgeable in that area. There are certainly excellent resources out there to provide information on that. It's important that we educate ourselves so we can respond appropriately. And be aware that there are specific workplace policies and practices that enhance recruitment, hiring, career advancement, retention, and disability inclusion. And if used, they will provide the kinds of outcomes, enhanced outcomes, that both businesses and we as consultants to businesses are looking for. It's important to become equipped to talk about issues beyond just people getting in the front door, such as top leadership commitment, meaningful disability inclusion, and the importance of managers' roles in minimizing perceived discrimination. And it's important to therefore become knowledgeable about ways that companies can measure their disability inclusion process once they have these different policies and practices in place. And we've designed an online tool I'm just going to mention that helps companies do that. It's called Benchmarkability. Can be reached at that URL, www.benchmarkability.org. It's a 90-item online tool that we're providing available at no cost across these areas that we discussed today: recruitment and hiring, diversity and inclusion, career development and retention, accessibility and accommodation, compensation and benefits, and metrics and analytics. So, all the things we talked about, there are items in there to help companies to self-assess how they're doing. It could also be, if you're a consultant and not a company, a way, if that company does that, for you to sit down and talk about what are some of the things, resources you might have to support them if there are areas that they feel that they need to do better in, would like to strengthen in some way. I also have provided in this PowerPoint, which our colleagues at Great Lakes ADA Center can provide you, if you don't have it directly, a list of related publications, many of which are available. They're open source, available online. There's two slides providing that, and then a slide that will give you the links to some of these online resources that we've designed. I've mentioned the Benchmarkability tool. I've mentioned disability statistics. We also have a code book on those different national census data surveys that have disability variables. We also have created an online tool that provides state-specific data on disability charges, so you can take a look at how your state is doing on these U.S. EEOC discrimination charges. And we have a repository of related publications, several hundred of them, plus a link to our specific project where we have many research briefs and videos from a State of the Science project, a conference that we had several years ago. So lots of free resources online for you to go to. And now I see that our colleague has given a prompt about being able to submit questions. And Peter, I'll turn it over to you to let us know if we have any questions waiting in the queue we need to immediately respond to.
All right, Suzanne, as you mentioned, for those of you in the webinar room, you can submit your questions in the chat area by simply clicking on the chat area, or if you're using assistive technology, you can submit your question in there as well. For those of you on the telephone, I'm going to ask Heather to rejoin us at this time to give instructions for our phone participants on how they can get in the queue to ask a question. Heather?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the star and the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Again, that is star, then one, to ask a question.
All right, and while we're waiting to see if we have any questions on the telephone, Suzanne, we have gotten some questions in the chat area. Let's start out with this one. You touched on this, but for an employer that whether it's a federal contractor, you know, that has an obligation, you know, the targeted 7%, to have 7% of the workforce be persons with disabilities, or it's a private employer that wants to see, you know, how well they're doing in attracting and hiring and retaining employees. From an employer's perspective, you know, how can they sell, a benefit to employees, those employees that don't have visible disabilities? How do they sell to their employees to self-identify so employers can, you know, get a handle on or get an understanding of what, you know, how much of their workforce is actually comprised of people with disabilities?
I would say, you know, there are a number of practices that help to do that. And I would say broadly there's two things they can do. One is send the message throughout everything they do that people with disabilities are wanted. What we've heard people say is if they see disability in the diversity statement, if they see their company actively recruiting people with disabilities, whether it be partnerships with community agencies or training recruiters to be more aware of how to minimize discrimination in that process, when they see that, it says to them that people with disabilities are embraced, are wanted in that workforce. So it makes people more confident when they're already in that workplace that they can come forward. So that's one set of policies and practices, just consistent sending of a message about disability inclusion. And the other is understanding of, and conveying how the individual will be advantaged as an individual by coming forward. And that might be having targeted mentoring programs for people with disabilities. I mean, or making sure that they're included in the mentoring process you may already have, making sure that equitable access occurs, making sure that equitable access occurs for training or stretch assignments or other opportunities, and letting people know that you really want, articulating that you want people who might have a disability, to know that if they want advancement, that if they're willing to come forward, you will work with them on accommodation and on an advancement plan with them so that they're strategically advantaged if they make that disclosure. So big picture, making sure that you send that message consistently about disability as a part of diversity and inclusion and the overall business imperative or strategy. And secondly, that individuals will get an opportunity to advance if they disclose, whether it be just accommodations that they might need, but also an opportunity for mentoring and professional development training that will be a part of the strategy of the organization to assist folks who might not otherwise get that opportunity.
Great. Thanks, Suzanne. And sort of a tie into that, the follow-up question, your work in this arena, are you seeing that employers are understanding the real benefits to outreach you know, hire, retain employees with disabilities, and not looking at it at perspective of, you know, we have these new Department of Labor, you know, rules for federal contractors that we have to, you know, have a target of 7%. Are our employers coming around and understanding the real benefits and that, you know, that disability really adds to, you know, diversity and benefits employers on many different levels?
You know, I can sincerely say I do believe that that is happening. It doesn't mean that we don't have lots more work to do, and it doesn't mean that the new regulations haven't been helpful. I think that they that spurs, external spurs, contextual spurs like that do put things back up on the forefront for us, and that's been an opportunity. But I also see employers genuinely trying to respond because of those requirements, but also because they feel it's the right thing to do. And in an economy that's coming back, we need workers. And so the practicality of also a stronger, economy right now is, I think, also emboldening companies to say, I want to give this a try. There's a reason to do so regulatory-wise, but also we feel more confident. We've had more opportunity to get exposure, and we feel it's something we can do. So I do think we're poised to be able to take advantage of all of these contextual reasons that I think are driving the door open for us to have more empowered conversations, either as internal advocates within businesses or those of us who are in the disability community and providing services to businesses.
I think so, Suzanne, and just I'm going to add one more onto that question.
As
you mentioned, you know, that the economy is improving. You know, following what we had seen happen back in 2008, we had seen a slowing of individuals within the baby boom generation, a slowdown, and those individuals retiring and individuals working, you know, later in life and not retiring at 65. And, you know, we hear people talk about this untapped pool of people with disabilities from a larger perspective. You know, our employment systems, our VR systems, you know, working with employers and identifying, you know, the skill sets and, you know, who are the employees that they're going to need in 2020, 2030, 2040, and beyond. So are the employment systems understanding from employers, you know, the skill sets that in general employees of the future are going to need, but in specific individuals with disabilities?
Well, I think, you know, I think we can always do a better job. I think certainly some workforce development centers, many community colleges, are working in close partnership with employers in their area and with workforce development and doing a really good job of not only preparing the workforce more generally, but also targeting previously socioeconomically disadvantaged groups, including people with disabilities. And there are many that are not doing as good a job. So we have an understanding that we need to do better, and I wouldn't say that we're doing so across the board, but I do think that there's an understanding that we need to do that. And some examples of that are, in the last 2 years, there have been White House initiatives to improve technology skills of the general workforce, but for people who need to get into the workforce, and there were specific initiatives for people with disabilities. So I think the understanding is there. I think we need communities to combine the interests of employers, educators, and local workforce development organizations to make sure that we really keep refining our understanding of what's needed, because those skills and those workplaces keep changing. So keeping on in front of them is a challenge, but it's imperative.
Excellent. And someone in the chat here, and we'll check with Heather in just a minute here, get this one more question out, wanted a clarification on what you mean by strong senior management commitment.
Well, I you know, simple answer is that the top of the organization, the CEO, says as clearly as this, that including people with disabilities is a part of our strategic imperative. We want a diverse workforce that capitalizes on all the skills and talents of Americans, and that includes people with disabilities. And that will be a part of our targeted diversity plan going forward, and we need everyone's help to make that happen. We need you as a work, as a labor force within our organization to help identify qualified candidates. If you're a supervisor or recruiter, that you help to see their talents and not differentially discriminate against them. And that once they're in, you help them to thrive, not just survive within our organization. And that message gets articulated verbally and in the strategic plan and imperative and in the performance appraisals of managers and people who are supposed to execute it.
And to that end, I'm going to ask one more question before we get to the phones. Someone in the chat area in the webinar room had asked about, you had mentioned internships as a good way for folks to get, for businesses, employers to attract individuals with disabilities. Someone wanted to know, are there successful practices within the private sector of getting employers to have those internship programs where individuals with disabilities can get in at that level?
Absolutely. I think many, many employers have had longstanding internship programs for and partnerships with preferred educational institutions where they would take interns for the summer. And some of them are making those targeted to include people with disabilities. So many employers have found this long ago and learned that this was an effective way to recruit, a low-risk way to try all kinds of talent out in the summer or for a semester, or it might be longer, for a year. But also to not only try out individuals with disabilities that they might have been more hesitant to flat out hire, but also to inform their supervisors and to give them an opportunity to understand that some of their fears are unfounded, some of their concerns about competency and qualifications can be transcended with an understanding of that exposure brings, and that they also may mitigate their fears around being able to know what to do when they have an employee with a disability. So it definitely is occurring. It's occurring in greater proportion among organizations, and we see terrific results when that does happen.
All right, there we go. Heather, do we have any questions from our phone participants at this time?
There are no questions over the phone lines.
All right, excellent. We've got a few more to go through that have come through in the webinar room. Someone asking about the statistics that you had used. I think the age range was 21 to 64. And so this person asked, with the big push for youth transition, do these statistics also apply to youth employment, or is that too new of a topic to have data yet?
Is the question, are youth employment more general and how, whether those are improving or not? Is that the question, Peter?
I think you're asking, do the data that you presented, 21 to 64, whether if there's any data out there, 16 to 20, or is it too early to have any? Is there any data in that area, and whether that youth data would mirror what you had presented for the 21 to the 64?
That's an excellent question, and there certainly is data. The national survey does collect data for a younger cohort. The reason why we don't present it is because often youth in the 16 to 21-year-old age group are still in the educational process and not in the workforce. So we were trying to get a litmus of comparison of people with and without disability that was more people would be beyond the school age years, and we'd truly be getting a test of the workforce participation rates rather than that cohort that might be not in the workforce, not because of discrimination or a lack of opportunity, but because they were otherwise engaged. So that's why we make that choice. But indeed, the data is available. I think you can choose to go down to 16, but I don't know off the top of my head on our website. But certainly the census does have that data. And if you have a question about that, you can send me an email. My email's on the first page or second page of the slides from the Cornell part of the slide deck. And you certainly can send me an email, and I'll pass that on to our disability statistics person who can respond with more precision to that question. But the data is available. Yes.
All right, excellent. And we're almost at the bottom of the hour. Just one last quick question. Someone had asked for a clarification. They had said, what does procedural and interactional justice mean?
That's a great question. It means that kind of two different experiences we have, two ways of looking at whether or not we're in a fair environment. One is, does the environment have clearly laid out protocols for how things get decided and done? That's procedural justice. So does it appear in general that the company has clearly articulated goals for how people, objectives, policies, and procedures for how people get into the workforce and how they advance? Or is it done kind of subjectively and idiosyncratically, which might not be perceived as procedurally fair? And interactionally just means that, for example, a supervisor applies the same kind of decision-making across each of the individuals that they work with. So interaction-wise, there is not a bias occurring, either because the policies and procedures are clear, but also because that individual tries very hard to be objective about applying those to each person equitably.
Excellent. All right. Well, we have reached the bottom of the hour. Just a quick reminder that our next ADA audio conference session will take place on March 21st, and that is titled Structured Negotiations, a Tool for Disability Rights. You can get information on registration for that session, as well as access to all of the archive sessions by visiting www.ada-audio.org, or if you have questions, you can call 877-232-1990. I want to thank Suzanne for joining us today. It's always a joy to listen to you present, not just for the 90-plus minutes that you spent with us today, but the time that you put in getting together today's wonderful presentation. So thank you very much, Suzanne, for joining us. Thank you to everyone that participated today. You're the reason why we do these sessions. Please take time to do the evaluation and let us know your thoughts on today's presentation and the audio conference in general. So again, thank you very much, Suzanne. Thank you all for attending today. That is the end of today's session. Everyone have a great day. Thank you.